Hello and welcome to The Economist. This is Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm volunteer reader David Leeper. And we're reading this week from the September 14 through 20 edition of The Economist. We'll begin, as usual, with The Leaders, a collection of five articles this week chosen by Economist editors to represent the major events and themes of the week. The first will be, How Ugly Will It Get? America's election is mired in conflict. And this, by the way, is the cover story. And the subheading is, Donald Trump's conspiracy machine is already gearing up for election night. Second, mixed message. Mario Draghi's best ideas are those Europe finds least comfortable. Subheading, the danger is that it picks the easy ones. Third, the dangers of rock climbing. Subheading, more storms are brewing in the South China Sea. Subheading, a dangerous new stage in the conflict is beginning. Fourth, corporate crusade, how to finish Japan's business revolution. Subheading, Tokyo-listed companies have become more friendly to shareholders, but the job is really only half done. And fifth and finally, subsidize people, not petrol. Nigeria's catastrophic fuel crisis has a straightforward solution, and the subheading is how to scrap a popular yet ruinous subsidy. Following the reading of those five leaders' articles, we'll turn to the main section of the magazine for articles from the United States, the Americas, Asia, China, Middle East and Africa, Europe, and Britain. So, turning now to that first leader's article, and again, this is the cover story. The title is, How Ugly Will It Get? America's election is mired in conflict. And the subheading, Donald Trump's conspiracy machine is already gearing up for election night. Even without Donald Trump on the ballot, American elections tend to create conflict. America is the only proper presidential democracy in which the person who wins the most votes does not necessarily win power. The two-month gap between voting and election certification in Congress is the most drawn out anywhere. Complexity invites legal challenges which add to the complexity. For all those reasons, American elections demand patience and trust. Unfortunately, the country comes joint last among the G7 on trust in the judiciary and dead last on belief that its elections are honest. And then there's Mr. Trump. At the debate in Philadelphia this week, the former president was angry and aggrieved. He repeated his false and outrageous claim that the election in 2020 was stolen, an assertion that nearly 70% of Republican voters say they endorsed. He and his party are gearing up to wage the post-election war a second time. Both parties agree that victory for the other side would threaten American democracy. For Mr. Trump personally, the stakes are even higher. If he loses, he could go to prison. If the election is not close, perhaps America might avoid another toxic transfer of power. Unfortunately, for America's increasingly beleaguered democracy, by our reckoning, this presidential race is tighter today than any since polling began. How messy will it get? There are three possible outcomes. Start with the extremely unlikely one, which is a vote so close that Kamala Harris and Mr. Trump tie in the Electoral College. Were this to happen, the next president would be picked by the House of Representatives, with each state wielding one vote. Even if Ms. Harris won the popular vote on November 5th, Mr. Trump would almost certainly become president. That would be fair in the sense it would follow the rules, but Democrats would be furious. The second outcome is a Trump win. Democrats could bring legal challenges in close states where Ms. Harris lost. Some of these might end up at the Supreme Court, where three justices appointed by Mr. Trump would have to adjudicate their merits. Three of the conservative justices worked on George W. Bush's legal team back in 2000 on Bush v. Gore. That would make it hard to persuade Ms. Harris's supporters that decisions favoring the Trump campaign were impartial. After the court's rulings on abortion and presidential immunity, Democrats have come to view the justices as Republican politicians in robes. Nevertheless, most elected Democrats would probably accept the rulings, if more grudgingly than in 2000. However, if enough Democratic lawmakers were really convinced the courts had acted unfairly, they could try to block certification of the result in Congress, following the precedent set by Republicans in 2021. Then 139 House members and 8 senators, all Republicans, voted to reject the results. A reform of the Electoral Count Act passed 2 years ago raises a threshold so that 20 senators and 87 members of the House would have to object. In the unlikely scenario that those preliminary votes passed, the Democrats would probably lose the subsequent full votes of both chambers. All this is possible, but the most probable outcome, if Mr. Trump were to win the election, is that Ms. Harris would concede, taking the wind out of any Democratic challenge to the result. If Ms. Harris wins, Mr. Trump will not be so gracious. In that third scenario, the complexity of America's voting system collides with the MAGA conspiracy machine. The Republican National Committee has preemptively filed more than 100 election lawsuits in the states to create a paper trail in preparation to fight the result. As a legal strategy, this would probably fail again, as it did in 2020. Fortunately, the governors of key swing states are not election deniers. Lawyers who might be tempted to bring the conspiracy theories to court ought to be deterred by the example of Rudy Giuliani, a Trump bagman who was bombarded by lawsuits. If some cases do get to the Supreme Court, John Roberts and 3 Trump-appointed justices may well be keen to demonstrate their independence by rejecting weak challenges. Democrats might yet come to see the Supreme Court as a guarantor of democracy. Yet a new Stop the Steal movement could fail legally while succeeding politically. In the last election, a shocking number of House Republicans voted to reject the result. Since then, the party has only become more beholden to Mr. Trump. Members either sincerely believe the other side wins only when it steals elections, or go along with that idea in public. Those who refuse, Liz Cheney, Mitch McConnell, Mike Pence, Mitt Romney, have been sidelined. If congressional Republicans did indeed secure a vote to overturn the election, they would probably lose. But the retailing of conspiracies could make the stolen election myth even stronger. One possible consequence of this myth is political violence. The Capitol will be so well policed in January 2025 that there will be no repeat of the riots on January 6. But local police, the Secret Service, and the FBI will have to prepare for protesters descending on state houses and for the risk of assassination attempts against lawmakers. About 20% of American adults say they're open to the possibility of using violence for a political end. In a large, well-armed country, you do not need many of them to mean it for that threat to be scary. Cheater-in-chief. The other consequence of the stolen election myth is the continuing degradation of American democracy. To be clear, America will still see a peaceful transfer of power in January 2025. Neither side will be able to install a president who lost by the rules, but that's a minimal definition of democratic success. In the broader sense, elections are meant to generate the consent of the people to be governed, even by a president for whom they did not vote. That requires voters to believe that the process is fair and can be trusted, so that their side has a decent shot in 4 years. Each time people feel an election lacks legitimacy, the day draws closer when one side or the other breaks the system rather than accept the result. And our second leader's article is titled Mixed Message. Mario Draghi's best ideas are those Europe finds least comfortable. The danger is that it picks the easy ones. Adam Smith thought that achieving spectacular economic growth required little more than peace, easy taxes, and a tolerable administration of justice. Don't tell Mario Draghi, who has just penned almost 400 pages on boosting European competitiveness, meaning economic growth. This is the second technocratic doorstopper commissioned by the European Union as it tries to bring stagnation to an end. As Mr. Draghi observes in our Online by Invitation column, An aging population means that if productivity growth does not rise, Europe's economy will be no bigger in 2050 than it is today. By the standards of such reports, Mr. Draghi's is commendably plain spoken. The former Italian Prime Minister and President of the European Central Bank writes with authority, and much of what he calls for is desirable. That includes more integrated markets so that startups can benefit from scale among their customers and their financial backers. Mr. Draghi also wants to unify decision-making on public investments to pare back the thickets of economic regulation that are ensnaring Europe's firms and to link up electricity grids. The biggest question was how much he would endorse the interventionist policies many politicians crave. Here, Mr. Draghi is too sympathetic to the mercantilists and their calls for subsidies for strategic industries, such as car making, the relaxation of competition and state aid rules, and tariffs on imports from China. He pays little heed to Europe's high-tech success stories, which owe more to markets than governments. Even the academic papers Mr. Draghi cites in support of his case are generally agnostic about whether state support brings aggregate benefits to an economy rather than just helping favored sectors. Yet Mr. Draghi is no crude protectionist. He admits, for example, that in some industries Europe should not attempt to match foreign subsidies on exports, but instead allow, quote, foreign taxpayers to contribute to higher consumption by European consumers, end quote. He often appeals to national security, which is a more solid basis for intervening than attempts to boost growth. If Europe follows his advice, its industrial policy will at least be thoughtful and guarded. Mr. Draghi's most headline-grabbing analysis is that Europe needs investment by the private and public sectors to rise from today's 22% of GDP to 27%. Germany, especially, needs this spending. Well-executed subsidies for R&D might work at a continental level, but Northern Europe has little desire for more joint spending, a subject that Mr. Draghi dances around. Another problem is that Mr. Draghi's recommendations are so numerous that policymakers will be able to pick and choose from among them. Europe is used to wringing its hands over competitiveness and urging investments in infrastructure and technology. Jacques Delors, a former president of the European Commission, did that as early as 1993. Yet extra spending and subsidies are no fix for the structural issues that require Europe to embrace reform. As Mr. Draghi also points out, the continent needs bigger, better, and more integrated markets, which require some centralization, but not dirigisme. If policymakers ignore this and instead use Mr. Draghi as intellectual cover for weakening competition and state aid rules, allowing governments of the EU itself to pursue an excessively interventionist agenda, then Europe's problems are likely to get worse. Mr. Draghi might have done better to have focused his message on the things that Europe's politicians do not want to hear. And our third leader's article is titled "The Dangers of Rock Claiming." More storms are brewing in the South China Sea. Subheading, a dangerous new stage in the conflict is beginning. 8 years ago, China lost a legal battle over its fantastical territorial claims in the South China Sea. An international tribunal ruled they had no basis. China responded by continuing to occupy and fortify reefs and rocks, and sometimes preventing fishing and energy development by other countries. Now the confrontation is heating up as Vietnam, the Philippines, and Malaysia challenge China's claims and aggression in different ways. Broadly speaking, the pushback is welcome. However, it should not be reckless. America should ensure that its ally, the Philippines, treads carefully. The encounters can be dramatic. On June 17th, Chinese coast guards wielded axes as they confronted Philippine sailors resupplying a beached warship that marks the Philippines' legitimate claim on Second Thomas Shoal. 2 weeks ago, China rammed a Philippine Coast Guard cutter on another shoal, tearing a gap in its hull. Such confrontations often go viral on social media with images of Chinese bullies with water cannons. They also feature in Sino-American diplomatic meetings, suggesting that both sides fear they could escalate out of control. The resistance by Southeast Asian countries has been years in the making and comes in different forms. Vietnam has mimicked Chinese tactics by building up its own outposts on reclaimed land in the Spratly Islands. Malaysia's government is generally a walkover. It allows China to patrol its fishing grounds and trade oil that is under sanctions in its waters. Still, even if it is now exploring for gas off Borneo inside the Nine-Dash Line, which China says marks its claims. The Philippines has been the most assertive of all. Since 2023, the administration of President Ferdinand Marcos has pivoted the country away from China. It has agreed to give America access to some military bases in return for an upgrade of them, and it has taken a tougher line on trying to enforce its maritime borders with patrols and public statements. All this is fair enough, but the danger for America is that it encounters at sea escalate too far, and if a military skirmish erupted, it might be obliged to defend the Philippines under their mutual defense treaty. There is already confusion. In May, Mr. Marcos said that the death of a Philippine citizen in any skirmish would be close to an act of war and predicted that America would hold the same standard. But Lloyd Austin, America's Secretary of Defense, declined to endorse Mr. Marcos's declaration. It's an invidious choice for America. It does not want to risk a wider war, yet if it failed to back an important ally, American deterrence would suffer in Asia and elsewhere, and China's illegal claims in the South China Sea would become more entrenched. So what to do? The first step is calibration and coordination by America and its allies, especially the Philippines. Under their treaty, America is bound to, quote, meet the common danger, end quote, in the event of an armed attack on a Philippine public vessel. Yet that does not mean the Philippines has a license to escalate of its own accord and expect Uncle Sam always to back it up. This year, the Philippines raised tensions by deploying a vessel to Sabina Shoal. And then, as different Philippine officials competed for influence, its Navy took action near Second Thomas Shoal without informing America or Mr. Marcos. That was foolhardy. Some hawkish members of America's Congress also play an unhelpful role, urging the Philippines to take unnecessary risks on the water without the power to back them up. Better to have careful coordination of where in contested waters Philippine vessels sail, public communication of this, and clear American backing in advance. A second priority is transparency. The more the world sees of China's claims and the ugly way it tries to enforce them, the less legitimate they will seem. Most countries used to suffer in silence. Now the Philippines has led the way by publicizing maritime incidents. Other victims of aggression should follow suit. That's likely to draw a broader group of states to criticize China. Several European countries now condemn its actions in the South China Sea. Next should be the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN. Some of its members who are chummy with China, including Cambodia and Laos, have blocked it from criticizing Chinese activity. Other ASEAN members should speak out anyway. It's strongly in their interest to uphold international maritime law. The South China Sea has become a riskier place. But a more predictable policy of deterrence by America and its allies and more exposure of Chinese misbehavior are the best approach to try to keep the peace. And our fourth leader's article is titled Corporate Crusade, How to Finish Japan's Business Revolution. And the subheading, Tokyo-listed companies have become more friendly to shareholders, but the job is only half done. Shareholder capitalism has had a difficult decade. Large companies around the world have been loaded with social, environmental, and national security goals that are outside their usual profit-making remit, often by governments. Corporate Japan, by contrast, has become far friendlier to shareholders of listed firms. Governance reforms that began after Abe Shinzo, became prime minister in 2012, have chipped away at stuffy and value-destroying practices long associated with Japan, Inc. The result has been a burst of confidence in Japan's hitherto stagnant economy. The fruits of reform have been tasty. Mergers and investor activism have surged. Share buybacks hit a record level in 2023, and Japanese firms have already pledged to repurchase over 12 trillion yen, or $85 billion, in their stock in 2024. And that's up to 25% of the total for all of last year. Foreign investors have noticed in the year to August, they snapped up 4.7 trillion yen or $33 billion in Japanese stocks. Warren Buffett, a storied investor, has bought stakes in cheaply valued Japanese conglomerates. For all the success, however, there's still huge room for improvement, particularly when it comes to deploying capital efficiently. The trouble is Japan's leaders are acting as if the job were finished. Corporate governance reform has increasingly been delegated to bureaucrats, and it's no longer a priority at the highest levels of politics. The best evidence that reform is incomplete is Japan Inc.'s woeful valuations. The price-to-book ratios of listed companies, a measure of their value relative to the worth of their assets, is a mere 1.5. By contrast, American companies are worth five times as much as the assets they hold. Japan's non-financial firms now hold 372 trillion yen, about $2.6 trillion, in cash and bank deposits, a figure that has risen by 82% in nominal terms since the end of 2012, suggesting that too many executives are resting on their laurels. Fortunately, some low-hanging fruit remains to be picked. Nicholas Benes, a former lawyer and one of the architects of recent reforms, has proposed several changes. Training new corporate directors in financial and legal skills would boost their performance at minimum cost to companies. Requiring official documents to be machine-readable would make it easier for analysts and investors to compare companies and for foreign investors to translate those documents into their own languages. More controversial changes are needed, too. Popular Japanese firms might be sold to overseas buyers who could manage them more efficiently. Alimentation Couche-Tard, a Canadian retail giant, has been trying to buy 7&I Holdings, which owns the 7-Eleven convenience store brand. 7&I has rejected Couche-Tard's first offer of $38.5 billion. For Japan to succeed, it's important that such deals are feasible. Other firms will conclude that less productive investments in Japan should be abandoned, which means that workers will be laid off. Toshiba and Omron, two Japanese electronics firms, have already announced layoffs. Managing this change and explaining its necessity to the public requires political leadership. Unfortunately, Japan's politicians have little zeal for further reforms. No hiding. The impetus for change today comes from the Tokyo Stock Exchange, which is pressing listed firms to explain how they're planning to raise their valuations. Pressure also comes from bureaucrats at the Financial Services Agency and Minister of Economy, Trade, and Industry, which have progressively raised governance requirements for companies and institutional investors alike. But prospective candidates for the leadership of Japan's Liberal Democratic Party, which governs the country and has done for all but a few years in its post-war history, have barely discussed corporate governance reform. If Japan's politicians cannot recapture some of the reformist zeal of the Abe years, there's little hope for even more difficult reforms, which are such as making Japan's rigid labor market more flexible. And unless Japanese companies deploy capital more efficiently, the country will struggle to cope with the challenges it's facing. Japan is the oldest large nation in the world, with 30% of its people aged 65 and over. Security threats from an increasingly bellicose Chinese government are rising. Japan hiked its defense spending by 27% last year and is increasing it by around 17% this year. Strengthening the economy to help pay for all this is crucial. A matter of such importance and urgency should not be left to technocrats alone. And our fifth and final Leaders article is titled "Subsidized People, Not Petrol." Nigeria's catastrophic fuel crisis has a straightforward solution. Subheading, how to scrap a popular yet ruinous subsidy. Wise petro states seek to turn oil revenues into human capital. By investing in better clinics, schools, and other public services, they nurture healthy, well-educated citizens who will thrive long after the oil runs dry. Nigeria offers its people cheap petrol instead. Nearly half the government's oil revenues are wasted on petrol subsidies, 2.3% of GDP, or four times the health budget. it should scrap this subsidy, a hard step that could be made politically easier by the start of petrol production last week at a huge refinery owned by Aliko Dangote, Nigeria's richest man. The subsidy has survived for decades despite several attempts to get rid of it. President Bola Tinubu announced at his inauguration last year that the fuel subsidy, quote, is gone, end quote. Yet it quickly returned. In its current form, it's convoluted and opaque. The state-owned Nigerian National Petroleum Corporation swaps locally pumped crude oil for petrol refined abroad and sells that petrol to Nigerian motorists at below market price. The vast losses it makes on this are deducted from the oil revenues it's supposed to pay to the state. This dramatically reduces what's available for public services. It's hard to exaggerate how terrible this policy is. It's inequitable because the benefits flow disproportionately to the car-owning middle class. It is dirty, encouraging Nigerians to burn more petrol. It's an open door to graft. Lorry loads of subsidized fuel are smuggled into neighboring countries, and because it costs a fortune to keep supplying cheap petrol, which the state cannot afford, petrol often runs out. In recent days, mile-long fuel queues have caused huge traffic jams. Some drivers wait all night to fill their tanks. Worst of all, lavishing more public money on fuel subsidies than on health and education combined makes it hard to approve the dismal quality of either. This is one reason why Nigeria is home to a sixth of its children who die before the age of five, and why the average Nigerian child absorbs only 5 years of schooling against 8.5 in Kenya. That's measuring what is learned, not how long the child spends in class. The waste of human potential is spectacular. Nigeria will be the world's third most populous country by mid-century. The World Bank estimates that with proper food, schooling, and health care, Nigerian children will grow up to be 2.8 times more productive. The difficulty is that the petrol subsidy is popular. Although it lopsidedly benefits the better off, every Nigerian swiftly feels the pain when it's reduced. A recent sharp increase in the official price of petrol has raised the cost of everything from groceries to electricity, since Nigerians often use petrol power generators at home. People are furious. Last month, police fired on crowds protesting against the high cost of living, leaving more than a dozen dead. The government is terrified of provoking further unrest, yet a failure to reform will only prolong the misery. There are two possible ways to persuade voters that scrapping the subsidy will ultimately benefit them more than it hurts. One is to end the fuel shortages by letting Mr. Dangote and anybody else sell petrol at market prices. The transition will not be smooth owing to the bottlenecks in domestic supply of crude oil, and it will mean higher prices, which people will hate. But Nigerians are sympathetic to the nationalist view that as an oil producer, their country should refine its own fuel. And the government might find political cover by blaming higher petrol prices on Mr. Dangote. More important, it should invest the money saved by scrapping the fuel subsidy in healthcare, education, and a less threadbare social safety net. Mere promises to do so will be widely disbelieved. Many Nigerians assume, with some justification, that any spare cash in state coffers is likely to be stolen or wasted on vanity projects. It's up to Mr. Tinubu's government to prove them wrong, and quickly. Much could go wrong, as it has before, but Nigeria's public finances are so wobbly that it can't carry on like this. It should stop subsidizing petrol and subsidize people instead. And roughly halfway through our broadcast today, we remind you you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm volunteer reader David Leeper, and we're reading from the September 14 through 20 edition of The Economist. And turning now to the main section of the magazine, we begin as usual with an article from the United States. This one is titled New Term, Same Balancing Act. America's college heads revise rules for handling campus protests. Subheading, university leaders have learned some lessons, but face a tough test this autumn. As some students shopped for Columbia hoodies and Taylor Swift crochet sets in the university bookshop, and others bought apple cider donuts at a farmer's market, It almost felt like a normal back-to-school September. But as classes resumed last week at Columbia University, the heart of last spring's campus unrest, over the war in Gaza, it was impossible to avoid renewed pro-Palestinian protests or the changes they have brought. Access to the campus is restricted to those with university ID. Near the main entrances, a conservative outfit set up two digital billboards that flashed the names and faces of people they considered to be, quote, Columbia's leading anti-Semites, end quote. Long queues blocked the gates periodically. On the first day back, a few dozen protesters shouted pro-Palestinian slogans, and two were arrested. Inside the gates, someone threw red paint on Alma Mater, a statue outside Lowe Library. College leaders used the summer to develop plans that might prevent disruptions, tackle anti-Semitism, and minimize resort to political forces, or rather police forces. The difficulty of that balancing act can be measured by the number of college presidents who have resigned while attempting to carry it out, including Minouche Shafik at Columbia, who stepped down in August. Despite much reflection and preparation, the autumn may offer her successor and other university leaders little respite. The anniversary on October 7th of the attack on Israel by Hamas is now one likely flashpoint. The problem remains how to combine a commitment to free speech with effective policies to prevent anti-Semitism, while also enabling all students to learn free of disruption. The First Amendment's speech protections apply only to state action, notes Lee Bollinger, a former president of Columbia and a free speech scholar. So whereas public universities funded by the state must allow unfettered speech, private ones are under no specific obligation. Fully adopting a First Amendment standard on private campuses would mean protecting hate speech or speech that advocates illegal action or speech that advocates deeply offensive ideas, so states Mr. Bollinger. Many universities believe that would be inconsistent with their mission. Tom Striticus, the president of Occidental College, a liberal arts college in Los Angeles, has implemented restrictions on the permissible time, place, and manner of demonstrations. Protests can take place only between 6 a.m. and midnight. Demonstrations cannot be mounted in buildings or block access, and no permanent or semi-permanent structures such as tents are allowed. Amplified speech from bullhorns, for example, is also forbidden. Many other colleges have applied similar restrictions. In an effort to limit the resort to police, Columbia University has hired more security guards and trained them in de-escalation techniques. In a written statement, Katrina Armstrong, Columbia's interim president, said that she supports, quote, the right to free expression, but those rights cannot come at the expense of the rights of others to live, work, and learn here free from discrimination and harassment, end quote. Last month, the university's task force on anti-Semitism concluded after conducting interviews with hundreds of Jewish and Israeli students that the university, quote, had not treated them with the standards of civility, respect, and fairness it promises to all its students, end quote. College leaders have realized they must prevent harassment and discrimination while also teaching students to handle some speech they do not like, another tricky balancing act. How they do this varies. Occidental College is requiring the incoming students to attend sessions on anti-Semitism and anti-Arab bias. McAllister College, a liberal arts institution in St. Paul, Minnesota, is joining the University of Northwestern, a private Christian college nearby, to provide students with opportunities to mix respectfully. Discussions can get heated and people can disagree, says Ravi Rajan, the president of the California Institute of the Arts, which specializes in arts education. Quote, but ostensibly one of the things that we're doing as an educational institution is teaching students how to have those arguments, end quote. Some university leaders have also learned another lesson. Keep quiet. A very curious phenomenon developed whereby college presidents were expected to speak up about world events, ranging from George Floyd's murder to the war in Gaza. So says Suzanne Rivera, the president of McAllister College. This was not expected of leaders in other sectors, she says, and it got some chiefs into trouble. Occidentalism. Dr. Rivera encourages college leaders to issue public statements only for events that directly affect their community and are aligned with the university's mission. She points to the recent Supreme Court decisions on abortion, which had an impact on health services on campus, and affirmative action, which influenced admissions as appropriate times to speak up. For those students brought up in a culture that still cancels people for views that run counter to left-wing orthodoxy, learning on a campus with a free speech philosophy can be difficult. Combine that with a contentious war and a presidential election, and university presidents can expect plenty of hard days ahead. I expect there will be protests on a number of issues this year, says Dean Stridicus, citing Occidental's history of civil disobedience. Again, quoting Dr. Stridicus, I have no illusion that it won't be complicated. And turning next to the section on the Americas, we have an article titled Dark Days. Venezuela's opposition is getting smashed. Can it find any way to thrive? In the end, the pressure grew too great. On September 7th, 6 weeks after we won Venezuela's presidential election in a landslide, Edmundo González fled for exile in Spain. The regime of Nicolás Maduro had accused the affable 75-year-old former diplomat of being a war criminal and issued a warrant for his arrest. But its real goal was to punish the opposition for releasing data proving that Mr. Maduro had lost the vote in late July. Mr. González's departure 4 months before he should rightfully take office is a crushing setback for those who are still hoping to spring Venezuela from dictatorship. Mr. González was a stand-in for Maria Corina Machado, a wildly popular former congresswoman whom the regime had banned from running for election. She had called on her supporters to vote for the former ambassador, and they did, in overwhelming numbers. Ms. Machado fully expected Mr. Maduro's creatures in the Electoral Council to lie about the result, so she organized the retrieval on Election Day of thousands of paper receipts from voting machines. These showed that more than 67% of votes had gone to the opposition. The Maduro government has answered with repression and more lies. Since the election, it has rounded up some 2,400 opponents, according to official numbers, most of them accused of terrorism. Many now molder in maximum security prisons. There will be no forgiveness, Mr. Maduro has said. The regime continues to peddle wild tales to support the claim that it won 52% of the vote. It says election officials could not provide a full breakdown of results because of cyber attacks. It insists electoral observers working for the Carter Center, an American NGO, were part of a coup plot. Protesters, it claims, are mostly drug addicts. Quote, the extent of this government's dishonesty has left me angry and speechless, end quote, so says Rafa, who drives a motorbike taxi in Caracas, the capital. Mr. Machado has pledged that Mr. González will, quote, continue the struggle, end quote, from exile. But after arriving in Madrid, he issued a statement that bore a whiff of resignation. Quote, only the politics of dialogue can bring us together as compatriots, end quote. So he said on September 9th. The next day, his daughter read supporters a punchier message from her father in which he says, I will not let you down. He has not yet made explicit whether he is still intending to assume the presidency in January. Sources in Caracas speculate he may be speaking carefully out of concern for relatives who remain in Venezuela. Now that Mr. González is out of the country, Mr. Maduro has begun to praise him. I can understand the step you have taken, and I respect it, smiled the president shamelessly. This is hardly the first time the regime has driven challengers into exile. In 2020, Leopoldo López, an opposition leader, left for Spain, vowing to continue the struggle from a place of freedom. His star has faded. Last month, he was loudly booed when addressing a mostly anti-regime crowd in Madrid. Consider also Juan Guaido, who in 2019 became a leader of an interim government created by the opposition. He went into exile in 2023 and now lives in relative obscurity in Florida. All this throws the spotlight back on Ms. Machado, by far the opposition's most potent figure. She is the daughter of a wealthy industrialist whose factories were expropriated by Mr. Maduro's predecessor, Hugo Chavez. She won opposition primaries last October with more than 93% support. The regime banned her from standing, but that did not stop her campaigning all across the country. She promised to reunite Venezuelans with loved ones who have fled from opposition, or rather from oppression, and economic collapse. Since Mr. Gonzalez's departure, she has told Venezuelans she will continue fighting, quote, here alongside you, end quote. She declared on X that the fight is until the end and victory is ours. Unlike Mr. Gonzalez, she emerged to speak at protests in the weeks after the election, most recently on August 28th. On each occasion, she quickly melted back into the crowds wearing a hood. For all her courage, the situation is desperate. The most recent protests have been smaller than demonstrations that broke out immediately after the election. The army has ignored her calls to defend the real result. The Supreme Court, dominated by the regime, has ruled in its favor. On September 5th, Ms. Machado said she wants Venezuela to become a world cause like apartheid South Africa in the 1980s. Yet so far, pressure from outsiders has been ineffective. Luis Inácio Lula da Silva and Gustavo Petro, the leftist presidents of Brazil and Colombia, are thought to hold the most sway in Caracas. They say they cannot recognize Mr. Maduro as president unless he can prove he won by publishing the voting machine's printed receipts. They have also tried to persuade the regime to talk to the opposition to find a compromise. Yet, on all counts, they're failing. It's said that Mr. Maduro will not even pick up the phone. The regime's next move could be against Ms. Machado herself. She says she's in Venezuela in hiding, but it seems improbable that the authorities have no clue at all about where she is. Her arrest would spark fresh protests and attract widespread condemnation abroad. Rick Scott, and a Republican senator from Florida, has said there will be hell to pay if Mr. Maduro harms or arrests her. That would doubtless include renewed calls for America to reimpose sweeping sanctions on Venezuela's oil industry, which were lifted in October in the hope of enticing the regime to hold a fair election, and which have since been only partly reinstated. Would any of this change Mr. Maduro's ways? Quote, when I hand it over power, when it is time, I will hand it over to a Chavista president, end quote, he said on September 2nd, referring to the leftist movement founded by his predecessor. His regime survived maximum pressure sanctions imposed by the United States under Donald Trump, so he says. On August 27th, Mr. Maduro made his vice president, Delcy Rodriguez, the new oil minister. Some see this preparation for renewed sanctions. Her role could be to do a better job of getting paid in the black market, says Francisco Monaldi at Rice University in Houston, Texas. Venezuelans fear the worst. Quote, on July 28th, I went with my entire family and we all voted for Edmundo Gonzalez, says a shop assistant in Caracas who declines to give her name. We all know who won. And now he has gone. God help us. And turning next to the section on Asia, we have an article titled Superpower Tensions in Asia, the Scary New Map of the South China Sea. Subheading, Fresh Fights Over Reefs and Shoals Test America's Credibility. On August 31st, a Chinese cutter rammed the largest patrol ship of the Philippine Coast Guard, punching a hole in its side. It was the latest attempt by China to force the Teresa Magbanua to leave Sabina Shoal, where it has been stationed since April. No one was injured, but the incident is part of an emerging new pattern of escalation and confrontation in the South China Sea, particularly around the Spratly Islands. According to one account, Wang Yi, China's top diplomat, warned Jake Sullivan, America's national security advisor, that China would not accept a Philippine presence at Sabina during their meeting near Beijing in August. The evidence points to a novel phase in the struggle for the South China Sea. Whether China and America can safely contain the nerve-shredding contest is far from clear. A major redrawing of the map of South China Sea began when Xi Jinping came to power in 2012. In the subsequent 3 years, China built 7 new bases in the Spratly Islands, 3 of them with large airfields on rocks and reefs otherwise claimed by Malaysia, the Philippines, Taiwan, and Vietnam. These bases now play host to a large permanent presence of Chinese troops, ships, and aircraft. Before, the most elaborate structures built by any country consisted of short airfields on some islands. China has placed great rhetorical weight on its vague claim to that part of the South China Sea, that is, nearly all of it, which falls within its 9-dash line. Sometimes the dashes move around on maps, occasionally a 10th dash is added next to Taiwan. Yet despite the vociferousness of China's claims, an uneasy status quo prevailed over the past half decade. On any given day, one or more Chinese Coast Guard ships and anywhere between a few and a dozen maritime militia vessels, typically large fishing vessels, have been stationed at disputed rocks and reefs throughout the sea. Until recently, their remit was limited. The vast bulk of commercial shipping activity, including containers, flows on some of the world's busiest sea lanes has been unaffected. China's Coast Guard has notoriously been preoccupied with preventing energy exploitation and fishing within the area. Even then, enforcement has been lackluster. A ban by China on fishing in the South China Sea every summer has not been seriously applied. The American Navy has maintained the practice of sailing past the islands on freedom of navigation operations, challenging China's claims to the area, having renewed such operations in 2015. Yet the number of such sailings has tailed off, and China has issued mainly routine objections to them. For an epicenter of a superpower contest, the South China Sea was often surprisingly placid. Compare with that, the squalls in this new phase of the confrontation. It threatens to become a storm. The Philippines, Vietnam, and Malaysia have begun to rebuff China more forcefully. In order to grasp this dynamic, it's important to consider the relative tension in levels across the area, calmest of all of the Paracel Islands. China has occupied them completely since seizing them from Vietnam in 1974. Of the largest of the 130 islands, China has an airfield and has deployed combat aircraft there. More tense is Scarborough Shoal, a single isolated lagoon. Its proximity to Manila, the capital of the Philippines, arguably makes it the South China Sea's most strategically important feature. Before 2012, Philippine vessels plied the lagoon's rich fisheries, and the Philippine Navy would expel Chinese vessels that tried to do the same. But that year, Chinese Coast Guard vessels forced the Philippine ships out, and brazenly, China has controlled it since. Most fraught of all are the Spratly Islands. The Chinese construction of large bases from 2013 to 2016 was on reclaimed land there, and as a result, the pushback is most vigorous there. Since 2022, Vietnam has been reclaiming land on features that it occupies. It has now built up about half as much land as China and appears to be constructing a large airfield. The Chinese government has remained silent on this matter. Malaysia has sought cozy relations with China and tolerated its ships in its exclusive economic zone. It has also turned a blind eye to fleets carrying illegally exported Iranian oil for transfer to China-bound vessels. Even so, Malaysia depends on energy revenues and has resumed oil and gas exploration off the coast of Borneo, close to the Spratlys, in the face of Chinese objections. The biggest pushback is coming from the Philippines. Ferdinand Marcos, the president, has directed his officials to shine a spotlight on Chinese activity in the Spratlys. Of particular note has been China's mission to prevent resupply of a Philippine Navy vessel, the Sierra Madre, which was grounded in 1999 on Second Thomas Shoal. Last year, the Philippines began using Coast Guard ships to escort construction materials to the Sierra Madre. China responded, and by June 2024, it successfully blocked resupply of the ship for 3 months. The small platoon of Philippine Marines guarding her began to run out of food and water. Finally, when the Philippine Navy mounted an attempt on June 17th, Chinese Coast Guards, armed with axes, boarded the Philippine dinghies and disarmed the sailors by force. The Philippine sailors followed orders not to fight back, but one lost a thumb. In July, China and the Philippines stepped back from a bigger confrontation, chastened by, at least for now. Chinese diplomats accepted a long-standing invitation from the Philippines to fly to Manila for talks. In the negotiations that followed, they agreed to provisional arrangements, which would allow regular resupply of the Sierra Madre. Under the agreement, China will inspect the resupply missions from a distance of several hundred meters to ensure they're not bringing in construction materials. But Philippine officials say the Sierra Madre has been stabilized with concrete and will now not float away. Elsewhere, however, tensions are growing, not least at Sabina Shoal, where Chinese ships rammed at Teresa Magbanua. Philippine officials say that they sent their ship to the shoal because they had seen signs China was preparing to build something there, but they're playing a risky game. The Philippines had no continuous presence at the lagoon before April, so it's changing the status quo, which China abhors. America and the Philippines are treaty allies. America commits to meet common dangers if a Philippine public vessel is attacked. But it's unclear if those guarantees apply at Sabina Shoal, as they almost certainly do at Second Thomas Shoal, where the Sierra Madre sits. While that ship is fixed with cement, Teresa Magbanua is afloat and so might be removed. The narrow significance of the Sabina incident is that it could spark a military encounter at sea. China might make more aggressive attempts to bully the Philippines out of the shoal. The broader implications go far beyond a few rocks and ships, since such an encounter would test America's appetite to come to the aid of the Philippines. Risking American lives and cash over an uninhabited shoal would be unpopular in Washington. Yet if the Philippines retreats, it is unlikely to get the shoal back. That would trigger memories of its loss at Scarborough Shoal in 2012 and prompt questions in Manila about the reliability of its bigger treaty ally. The past few months offer two starkly different visions of how the South China Sea will operate in the 2020s and beyond. One, based on the Sierra Madre episode, points to the sea being a contested zone where all parties are capable of de-escalating around flashpoints. The other vision can be found at Teresa Magbanua, a constantly shifting set of mini-confrontations in which China seeks to enforce its will on the sea while Southeast Asian countries push back. When the repelling is carried out by formal allies, it puts America in a horrible dilemma. Does it back them up or urge them to back down? China will watch like a hawk what happens next. So will other American allies in Asia and beyond. And turning next to this section on Middle East and Africa, we have an article titled The Philadelphia Story. A narrow corridor in Gaza has become an obstacle to a ceasefire. Benjamin Netanyahu says the presence of Israeli troops is crucial, but his generals disagree. On Israeli tactical maps, the narrow corridor along the border between the Gaza Strip and Egypt is codenamed Philadelphia. It's a rubble-strewn wasteland just 14 kilometers long and around a kilometer wide. And yet, it has become one of the main obstacles to a ceasefire agreement, which could perhaps end the war in Gaza. Benjamin Netanyahu, Israel's prime minister, claims the corridor is the main smuggling route through which Hamas's Iranian benefactors supplied the weapons that enabled the group to launch the devastating attacks on Israel on October 7, 2023. He insists it is critical for Israel to maintain a military presence there. If the Israel Defense Forces withdrew from the Philadelphia, Mr. Netanyahu claims, Hamas would be able to secure the resources to carry out another October 7th and another. On August 29th, the Israeli cabinet passed a decision to keep troops in the corridor indefinitely. That may scupper any chance of reaching a deal, to secure the release of 101 Israeli hostages still held in Gaza. The generals and spy chiefs within Israel's security establishment disagree with their prime minister, and it's puzzling that if holding the corridor is so central to Israel's security, Mr. Netanyahu waited 7 months after the war began before giving the order to occupy the territory. To understand the importance of the Philadelphia corridor, start overground, then go under. The area is based on the border demarcated early in the 20th century between the British and Ottoman empires. But that was just a line on a map. The first time a physical border fence went up on the Philadelphia corridor was part of the peace agreement between Israel and Egypt. In 1982, Israel returned to Egypt the Sinai Peninsula, which it had captured in the Six-Day War in 1967. Egypt, however, had no interest in controlling the Gaza Strip, which it had kept under military occupation between 1948 and 1967. So Israel occupied Gaza until it unilaterally withdrew from the Strip in 2005. Mr. Netanyahu claims that leaving the Philadelphia corridor at that point was a fatal flaw in Israel's disengagement from Gaza, implemented by the then prime minister and his rival for leadership of the Likud party, Ariel Sharon. He ignores conveniently the fact that the network of tunnels under the border was excavated and the smuggling trade through them flourished from the 1980s onward, when Israel was still in control of the corridor. Israeli security officials insist that while a few tunnels were still being used in recent years, major engineering and demolition operations carried out by the Egyptian army on its side of the border had destroyed most of them and put an end to the commercial-scale smuggling. IDF officers say that most of the tunnels they have discovered since they began searching in May have not been used for years. Going forward, even if a solution can be found that satisfies both Israel and Hamas, which insists on guarantees for a full Israeli withdrawal before releasing any hostages, six of whom it recently executed, a ceasefire is far from assured. Neither Hamas nor Israel's hardliners seem capable now of reaching one. On September 4th, Mr. Netanyahu was asked whether Philadelphia was the only obstacle to a deal, and he laughed. "No, it's not," he said. In fact, he continued, "everything can still be an obstacle. Philadelphia is just the latest excuse." And with that, we come to the end of this week's reading of The Economist. This is Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm volunteer reader David Leeper, and we've been reading from the September 14 through 20 edition of The Economist. As a reminder, if you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand anytime on our website, www.sunsounds.org, under Broadcast Info and Audio. Thank you for listening, and please join us again next week when we will again read from The Economist.